j'aurais oublié d'où je viens et qui je suis, et quelle est ma patrie dans le temps, alors ce jour anniversaire de la Commune de Paris, c'est à nous maintenant, pour ceux qui la connaissent, d'entonner à la mémoire des nôtres, morts pour la liberté, l'internationale. Debout les damnés de la terre.
That is the sound of supporters of the New Popular Front, specifically Jean-Luc Mélenchon, singing the Internationale in Paris, France, on June 7th, the night where the NPF surprisingly defied the polls and my predictions by outpacing the fascists of Le Pen and dwarfing the size of what remains of Macron's party. We had an episode leading up to the elections with Henry Wallace, and due to popular demand, he is back. So for this episode, the first half hour or so is going to be him giving a little audio essay summary of what's happened so far, and then Sean and I will be back to interview him about that, talk about it in the U.S. context, try to probe around for some critiques of the Popular Front, and Henry also goes into a little bit more detail about Mélenchon's social theory about how socialism can be won today. So it's a great interview. Stay tuned for that. If you want to support the show, please do at patreon.com/theantifada. You can get access to our Discord community where you can talk about the episode and also talk to some of our guests who are a part of the Discord, including Henry Wallace and Nick Chavez, who we had on last week. And you can also get all the bonus content, full episodes, our back catalog, and most importantly, it keeps the show running. So please support. You can sign up for $5 a month, and you could also sign up for a 17% discount if you buy a year subscription in advance. And we always really appreciate that. So, without further ado, here is Henry.
Hello, this is Henry Wallace reporting in from France, where the results of the 2024 legislative election have led to a stunning victory for the left-wing New Popular Front, to the chagrin of both the far right, who the press, the pollsters, the bookmakers, and even the politicians assumed was going to win, and the neoliberal extreme center of Emmanuel Macron. Now, this victory is, of course, relative. The election delivered the New Popular Front as the largest single political bloc in the National Assembly, but did not give it an absolute majority. That is, the New Popular Front is not in a position to simply impose its program unilaterally. It will require votes from other political forces, from various deputies belonging to different parties, in order to get elements of the program advanced piece by piece. Nonetheless, it is, and I cannot stress this point enough, a relief for millions of people, both in this country and around the world, to see the neo-fascist defeated, and it's also an inspiring and politicizing moment where people begin to look at each other post-COVID for the first time and say, actually, some kind of collective project is possible. So before I go any further, for those who did not listen to the recent interview between me, Andy, and Sean, I recommend going back and listening to that. If you would like more detail, please go to helotage.com, that's my website, where you can read articles about the situation and, you know, have facts and figures laid out. My goal here is to summarize what's occurred and then jump into why I think it matters internationally and what might be coming next. So for those who are ignorant of French politics, we have a semi-presidential system where there is a head of state, the president, and a head of government, the prime minister. The Constitution of the Fifth French Republic is designed to produce clear majorities. Usually, the president and the prime minister are members of the same political force, and so you have a coherence between international and domestic politics. Sometimes this breaks down, and the president's party loses in a legislative election, and the president is induced to name a prime minister of his opposition. This is called a cohabitation. What's happening in France today is a breakdown of this constitutional system, where even though Macron and his forces had a relative majority before this election, and now the New Popular Front has a relative majority, President Macron is denying the results of the election. That is, he's going around saying nobody won. And in fact, it was very bizarre the night, you know, when the second round of votes came to an end, he was nowhere to be seen. And we were waiting for days just to have any response from him at all. And, you know, I don't have any insight onto the inner workings of the Élysée Palace, but one gets the impression that he didn't really know how to respond, because his party lost the European parliamentary elections, so he called snap legislative elections that he himself claimed would clarify the situation, and then he lost to those. And not only did he lose those, but every attempt since then from his forces to try to triangulate and form a coalition have failed. So the New Popular Front has been calling on him to say, hey, where's our new government? And his own people, you know, the outgoing Prime Minister Gabriel Attal resigned, and Macron refused his resignation, said, no, you have to stay in office for a while and manage, you know, ongoing affairs. And this is, in a way, normal, you know, there's a transition, whatever. But these transitions, historically, last for, I don't know, maximum of a week or so. And President Macron is basically saying that we're going to go on until the end of the Olympic Games. So the outgoing government, this group of ministers that have been electorally defeated, are going to maintain power and continue to govern for an indefinite amount of time. And folks are getting increasingly upset about this. Just to give one example of this, the head of the General Confederation of Labor, the CGT, Sophie Binet, called on everybody to put, quote, the National Assembly under surveillance and for, quote, permanent mobilization. And going into the Olympic Games, that's a pretty serious manner of talking. You know, we were out there protesting the first day that the new National Assembly met on the 18th of July to elect a president of the Assembly. And in that vote, in the first round, the New Popular Front proposed André Chassaigne, veteran Communist Party politician. He got 200 votes, if my memory serves me correctly, out of 577 total. Everybody else was falling pretty far behind him. And after a couple rounds of voting that included ballot stuffing, which is not exactly normal in this country, so, you know, they had to redo, I think, the third round of voting because of that, the outgoing president of the Assembly, Yael Braun-Pivet, was retained. And this was basically due to a coalition of the moment between Macron's center and the right wing. But this is also in itself kind of absurd, because the French people went to the ballots, they voted down Macron's forces, and they voted down the center-right, and now we have this sort of center-right president of the Assembly still in charge. And even though the New Popular Front lost this election, it demonstrated the solidity of the front in the face of all of the forces of the media and the, you know, other political powers trying to break the NFP apart. It's still the biggest single bloc in the Assembly. And it also demonstrated that there's a complicity between Macron, who is extremely unpopular, and the right wing. So what has changed politically as a result of this election? We now have a united left in the New Popular Front, which is the single strongest political bloc. Macron's center coalition is fracturing. To his left, on the social democratic center, there are people like the outgoing Prime Minister Gabriel Attal, who are not very happy. To his right, his former Prime Minister Edouard Philippe and his top cop, Gérald Darmanin, are also making noises about maybe contesting for Macron the leadership of the center. In the post-Gaullist right wing, we have a divorce ongoing between those Républicains who did not want to support the far right and those who did. So Eric Ciotti has taken his faction and formed a new group, and Laurent Wauquiez has taken his faction and formed a new group. Then, on the far right, we have an interesting situation in which they've basically been humiliated, or if not humiliated, they've been certainly rebuffed in a way that's very frustrating for them. They've gained, you know, deputies, they've gained strength, but they're still shut out from key posts. So it seems to me, and I'm not an expert on their internal machinations, that their move is to sort of bide their time. Sophie Binet, who I spoke about earlier, put it that they are waiting in ambush. And a lot of people are thinking that, you know, the next legislative election could be next year, and the 2027 presidential elections are approaching. So it's certainly something to think about. I'd like now to turn away from the parliamentary aspects and talk about the campaign, and then about why I think this matters internationally. This campaign, and, you know, I would like to apologize to the listeners. The last time I spoke with Sean and Andy, I was a little bit overwhelmed in the middle of the campaign, and I feel like some of my responses weren't as clear as they might otherwise have been had I a little bit of hindsight and rest. But this campaign was extremely energetic. We were everywhere. We were in all of the housing projects. We were everywhere that people could be found. And we would talk with anybody. And we talked to everybody. And, you know, I don't want to sound glib or patronizing, but it was a very emotional experience having people come up to me with my kid in the stroller and, you know, thank me from the bottom of their heart. I was talking yesterday with a couple organizers that focused in the housing projects, and they'd knock on somebody's door, and the mother of the family would come out and kiss the materials. They'd kiss the propaganda because they knew what it represented. And I remember on the eve of the second round, I couldn't believe that we won. So many of us were resigned. I mean, I think I even said this on the show. A lot of the reason why I was mobilized in the campaign personally was because I wanted to make very clear that I opposed the far right and I opposed this sort of neo-fascist threat. And I thought that, you know, it was very probable they were going to come to power. And if I didn't act before they did, then I wouldn't seem credible once they had. But not only did we prevent them from coming to power, but we won the election. And I was just sitting there and, you know, listening to the results come in and just crying. I just was weeping because I couldn't believe that not only had this country said no to the fascists, but we had said yes to a program of rupture. A program that says no to neoliberalism, that says no to immiseration, that says no to ecocide. A program that says yes to solidarity, that says yes to working class power, that says yes to immigration and immigrants. And this is something that I think, you know, some people have told me, some Americans have told me that they're suspicious of the New Popular Front, etc., because of the Kanaky New Caledonia issue. I want to make something very clear. We have deputies from New Caledonia, from Kanaky, who are independentists, that are independence activists. And if you go around and you go to a France Unbowed meeting, they have the flag of Kanaky and there are Kanak people there. We are the political force, we, the NFP, are the political force that is most opposed to imperialism and neocolonialism. Whatever you think about Jean-Luc Mélenchon, he's going to Kinshasa and Dakar and talking to people in Africa about the need to have independence from, you know, European imperialism, etc., etc. So the idea that we don't have, you know, enough care for these people is absurd. And furthermore, I want to say something very important, which is that when you turn on the TV as an immigrant, and every day the question of whether or not you can be trusted, whether or not your children should have full and equal rights as much as, you know, white children born in this country of long-standing generations. And then you turn on the TV the night of the election and you hear the New Popular Front get up and say, this country, this people is not defined by race. It's not defined by ancestry. It's not defined by religion. It's not even defined by the French language, which maybe you as an immigrant, you don't feel very confident in. What defines this people is a shared common good, a shared political future. And what is our program? The program on the New Popular Front? It's everybody lives better and a new constitution that delivers real power. A rupture with the neoliberal hell that created these conditions, that forced you across the Mediterranean, that forced you across the Sahara Desert, that forced you to separate from your family, etc., etc., etc. And when you hear somebody like Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the night of the election, get up and say, we won, and thanks to who? It was thanks to the tireless work of the pro-Palestine activists. It was thanks to who? It was thanks to the folks in the ghetto. It was thanks to who? Etc. You can imagine the rest of it. And I think this is a very key political issue also. There has been an ongoing debate for years in French politics about this alleged loss of the working class to the far right. And there's truth to it. The PCF, a lot of the historical left parties, lost a lot of voters to the far right in the 90s, 2000s, and even today. But there is a conception of the working class which is racialized, similar to the white working class discourse in the U.S. And the France Unbowed, which I think is basically hegemonic in the New Popular Front today in terms of its sort of intellectual dimension, is very clear, saying, actually, in a lot of districts, there's 30% of the people that don't vote. Why are we going out and catering on matters of, you know, security and immigration on the terms of the far right? We should be campaigning on terms of rupture with the status quo, of rupture with capitalism, with a citizens' revolution. Why is it a citizens' revolution? It's a citizens' revolution because it's made both in the streets and electorally. And this is maybe the aspect that we'll talk about if I have a chance to talk to Annie and Sean later, is a sort of theory that's animating this movement for many years. But the New Popular Front didn't happen by accident. Folks like Mélenchon and Mathilde Panot and Manuel Bompard and the rest of the New Popular Front, and specifically the France Unbowed politicians, have had a theory that they have been trying to apply for years of uniting all of the historical left forces from the NGOs to the unions to the political parties, and then surpassing the left by building a popular movement that has a concrete program. It's not just based on resentment. It's not just based on, you know, we want Macron to resign, although I would be happy for him to resign. But it's based on advancing a concrete program. And part of that program is a rupture both economically with the political economy of the European Union and the norms, both monetary and in terms of budgetary, etc., but also a rupture with the current constitution of the French Republic and the possibility of a constituent assembly that creates a new republic and thereby a new people. Because the French people is legally and politically constituted, according to this point of view. And this tradition, this culmination, is not something that just sprung out of thin air. It has roots. If you go back and read from Robespierre, Babeuf, Blanqui, Jean Jaurès, Léon Blum, even people like François Mitterrand, whatever we think about him. And, you know, Mélenchon has a critique of Mitterrand. But there is an idea that you have to have both a strong labor, a strong civil society, a strong street presence, and a strong electoral presence in order to make a revolution. And this is the objective of the France Unbowed. And this is why the France Unbowed is constantly demonized, and in my view, why the far right is constantly normalized. Because in terms of recuperating the resentment and the anger and the anguish caused by the neoliberal world order, the far right is a much better candidate to do that, because the far right does not propose any rupture. The far right proposes some kind of piecemeal reforms. And even these reforms that they propose are, you know, similar to like the Obamacare style, where actually in the end it's kind of a half-assed mess that favors certain businesses over others, and they're ready to renounce at the first, resistance. And what we've seen is the far right basically, little by little, in order to win, they don't actually have the popular basis that the left has. So they have to try to win over the right wing. This is the sort of evidence of the Ciotti move, right? Ciotti figured that locally it would be better for him to align with the far right so that they would have a more solid electoral basis together. So in terms of the campaign, in terms of the stakes, there's nothing about right-wing populism that is unstoppable. There is an alternative to the social democracy of Blair and Hollande, and there is an alternative to the left populism of Sanders and Corbyn and Tsipras. There is actually a principled left theory and practice that can build a movement, including from the streets. Because again, if you listen to Mélenchon, he's not afraid to talk about manning barricades. He prefers not to man barricades, but on multiple occasions, manning barricades is necessary. So there is a line from the barricade to the ballot box that does not imply, in my view, a renunciation or rejection of a revolutionary potential. But on the contrary, seems to me, based on my life and the, 15 years of experience I have in politics, that has never been seen elsewhere. I've never seen anything like this. 3 months ago, I didn't really have a lot of meetings to go to. There wasn't a lot going on. Now, every week, people are organizing. And it's very important to note that they're organizing in a transversal way. 1 week, it's people organizing in defense of human rights against police violence. Another week, it's people organizing for the France Unbowed. Another week, it's people organizing on the level of the union. And all of these people know each other, are getting to know each other, are communicating, and are organizing independently and autonomously. That is, yes, if you're part of the union, you have Sophie Binet at the head of it, there's a little bit of a pyramid. But locally, you still have quite a bit of latitude. And contrary to traditional left parties, one of the reasons why the France Unbowed has become so successful is that they have a much more horizontal practice. You don't have to pay money and have a card and formally register. You have a public website that's, I think, they took from Bernie Sanders and then used in a different way, this sort of canvassing technology, where you can just go and see on a map, where's the latest event near me? You show up and you do whatever you want, and you don't have any obligation to do anything or to pay anything or to believe in anything you don't want to believe. So I'm meeting lots of people that mobilized in the Yellow Vests that are now mobilizing the New Popular Front. And remember, the Yellow Vests was not some kind of left-wing organization. The Yellow Vests included people from all political perspectives except maybe, the extreme center, right? Everybody left and right that was upset participated in the Yellow Vest at some degree. And so this constellation of different forces that has come together and a kind of point of this common program, I think there's a lot of power to it. There's a lot of organizational potential to it that remains. And the questions that I'm facing is that basically in August, everything in France shuts down, including your business. You can't get hired for a job. It's kind of, everybody goes on vacation, which I think is good. This is one of the victories of the historic French left. However, it does risk a kind of demobilization. And this is what Macron seems to want. He wants people to shut up about politics and watch the Olympics. I'm still seeing people organizing their events planned for August, which I'm going to attend. I'm going to attempt to continue to mobilize with folks. But I think there's a real chance that we're going to have to wait until September and October, when the school year starts again, to really find out whether or not there's permanent mobilization, whether or not people are serious about fighting the political fight. So as I come up to the end of my time, I would like to do a little bit of a mini history as a weapon and discuss the history of the French left in broad strokes so that all of what I'm talking about is in both historical and international context. We can say the French left began with a republican socialist tradition issuing from the revolution of 1789. and cemented with the Declaration of Rights of Man of 1793 and Constitution of the Year One, which ever since then has been interpreted maximally by a tendency of the French left, including Auguste Blanqui, Jean Jaurès, because if you read the Declaration of the Rights of Man of 1793, the right to property is a social, not a natural right. That is, it is a right which is subject to certain conditions. And as Blanqui put it in his Dedicatory to the Mountain of 1793, published in 1848, quote, "The mountain had sublime inspirations, offering of the gospel and philosophy, but it never devised the kind of positive theories that emerge only slowly from a ruthless analysis of the social body, just as the art of healing is born of the revelations of anatomy. Nevertheless, if it lacked science and organization, its good-hearted enthusiasm sufficed to inspire the immortal formula of the future, liberty, equality, fraternity, and that admirable symbol, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, which, broadly interpreted, contains the seeds of all the developments of future society." And this is not some weird opinion of him alone, but you can hear this when you talk to French left-wing people today that are part of this Republican socialist tradition. There is, however, a different tradition, or multiple different traditions in the French left, one issuing notably from the German social democratic tradition of Bernstein, Kautsky, etc., that led to real debates, and including international debates in the early 20th century, where Rosa Luxemburg and Jean Jaurès found themselves on one side and Kautsky and Jules Guesde on the other, concerning whether or not German workers, for example, needed to form a German republic, or whether they had everything they needed to make the struggle within the political strictures of their Reich, of the German Empire. And then, of course, in 1917, the whole situation changed, where the French left converted en masse to Bolshevism, and there remained, you know, a non-Bolshevik strain, but in the resistance and in the immediate aftermath of World War II, the Communist Party was the single strongest political force in the working class. And I'm not even talking about all of the different anarchist tendencies in the name of time. Then, as disillusion with the Soviet Union grew, and we had 1968 and the New Left, we had a sort of diffusion of different, you know, autonomist, situationist, etc. movements, and finally a political expression in François Mitterrand, which established quite a number of social advances, including, you know, decriminalizing homosexuality, criminalizing discrimination based on gender or sex, retirement at 60, increasing of wages, etc., 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 nationalizing industries. But if you listen to people from the France Unbowed and from the sort of left wing of the Popular Front, their critique of Mitterrand, like Mélenchon has discoursed on this many times and at great length, is that, first of all, Mitterrand and his generation were traumatized by the Second World War and traumatized by the events of Chile with Salvador Allende, and were afraid of both making a monetary rupture with Germany and sparking a repetition of the monetary crises that had, you know, sundered the 20th century, and were also afraid of calling for mass mobilization post-68 and risking a repetition of the Allende sequence. So those are like two of the elements. The other elements that somebody like Mélenchon would bring up is the limits and the strictures of the European Union and of the sort of basically the left had its opportunity in the 80s, the 70s and 80s to make its move. It fumbled. It lost the balance of power. And ever since then, post-Soviet Union, it's been trying to gather itself up and make another sort of assault of power. And, you know, Mélenchon knew Mitterrand personally, and Mélenchon was in government with Lionel Jospin when, you know, post-fall of the wall, communists and socialists came to power and reduced working hours without reducing wages. So it's not like he's talking about some history that he doesn't know personally. And I think what's really interesting about the French left today, and the France Unbowed in particular, is their strategy is rooted in historical materialism. It's rooted in a very simple analysis of what's going on in the world as it is today, It's not wedded to a kind of fetishism of the left, of a sort of left sectarianism. And it recognizes that the workers' movement has declined in strength and that there's a new social reality emerging, this new social reality of mass population growth, migration, and urbanization, such that our move today, at least according to them, is mobilizing people in the cities, mobilizing people on the basis of a shared political project that includes union activity, that includes feministist militancy, ecological militancy, the Kaneki and New Caledonia independence movement, that includes all sorts of different social factors, even just things like human rights and good government and anti-corruption, with a truly left program, a common left program. And this is what Mitterrand had, this is what Jaurès had, this is what people like Mélenchon in his whole career up until now did not really have, is this moment of convergence on a common program. So I think that's really the thesis that's being proved out now. And personally, I never really took Mélenchon and the France Unbowed very seriously until this summer. I was not investigating them or working with them very much. I ran into some of them at like Yellow Vest protests or whatever. They seemed nice, but I wasn't interested in their electioneering. Now I'm listening to what they have to say because I think that they've demonstrated an ability to mobilize a large quantity of people and to speak to people. When I talk to, I'll put it bluntly, as we say in French, racialized people, the France Unbowed meetings don't look like your normal union local meetings. They don't look like the good government meetings. They don't look like the human rights meetings. They're younger, they're more diverse, and they're more representative of the population of the neighborhoods where they operate. And they don't operate on the basis of some kind of pyramidal structure where Mélenchon's at the top, but on the basis of every local group decides for itself and every person decides for themselves what they want to do and what level of commitment they're willing to give. I will also end with another word about the international scene. I'm currently going back and listening to and annotating the discourses of Mélenchon at Kinshasa and Dakar. And it's clear to me that his political tendency is looking for international allies. And I think it's worth considering what we can all, in our own context, learn from this strategy that brings together a mass movement of people underneath a common program, which is reflected on the basis of a public and reasoned theory of action that proposes a rupture with the capitalist neoliberal world order and the creation of a new people and a new world, a new humanity that lives in harmony with the earth and with each other.
Cool. Thanks for that report back, Henry. We did have some people who really liked the last episode and wanted to hear more. So as long as stuff keeps happening in France, you'll be our French correspondent. Obviously, what's happening in France right now is the Olympics.
Yeah.
And I saw that video of you. You were at you were outside the Israel-Mali soccer game, and you had that interview.
I thought it was a good game. I thought in the beginning Israel was better, but now Mali is getting is destroying them, I think. Israel is not bad. Israel is not bad. But
I think
Mali is going to destroy them today. No, I'm just talking about football. I'm just talking about football.
Mali is the best. No politics here. Okay?
Free Palestine. Free Palestine.
Very impressive fake French accent.
That did kind of look like you, homie.
Thank you for the kind words is all I can say. And I'm happy to be the France correspondent, at least until I'm fired.
Or at least until...
Antifada downsizing.
No, that ain't going to happen, man. We're in it for the long haul.
As long as you don't ask us for any money, we're not going to fire you.
Understood.
Yeah, as long as current events keep happening, we'll have you. So What's new, man? What's going on? We got elections over there. We got elections over here. What happened with your popular front? How'd you do?
Well, as I said in the pre-record, or Andy, am I not allowed to say it was pre-recorded?
No, it's clearly pre-recorded.
All right, but Sean didn't listen to it, so I'll just repeat very clearly.
Okay. I'm a busy guy.
He's a working man. He doesn't have time to listen to pre-records.
Yeah, that's right.
Basically, we won. Everybody said that the far right would win, but we won. And we won because we had a better ground game and because we had a particular theory of action, which was demonstrated in practice. The theory of action was that there is a new sort of subject of history, and this subject of history can be mobilized electorally and was mobilized electorally. Now, I'm saying this sort of speaking as the spirit of the New Popular Front. I am a little bit ambivalent about whether or not the theory is 100% accurate, but it's good enough that it delivered us a relative majority in parliament. The issue is that basically the president and the powers that be are trying to undermine the results of the election by pretending it didn't happen, basically.
Yeah, so Macron's sort of putting a decision about what the new parliament's going to look like on hold until after the Olympics, right? And that's another...
Because there's sort of an ambiguity in the constitution of the Fifth French Republic, where normally the way it should work is that the president and the prime minister and the government are all aligned. They're all in the same political force. Sometimes this doesn't happen. And I mean, as Sean, as an old man, you remember all of the different cohabitations of dear François Mitterrand. Know that this can go a different kind of way. But there's an ambiguity in the constitution about, does the president name the prime minister? Or does he choose? And if you read the law, as I understand it, he names the prime minister. That is, he recognizes the result of the election and, you know, says, okay, now you're in charge. Whereas the way a lot of people on the right especially are reading it is that he chooses a prime minister. Mm. As if the election is just kind of advice, you know, like it's just... Hey, take it or leave it, you know.
So the first way is very similar to like a constitutional monarchy like in Britain. So the election will go off and there'll be like a majority that's formed. And then you have to go to the king, to King Charles, and be like, hey, homie, we got enough people to form a government. And
yeah, because Macron is our king. He's the Republican.
Yeah,
he's the president. He's the head of state.
Right. It's like the executive model is based upon a constitutional monarchy. It's just that he's...
Yeah.
Right.
And it's actually, I mean, I wrote this in one of my recent articles, which I don't think either of you read, which basically says that the Constitution of France and the Constitution of Russia are actually the two closest in Europe in terms of similarity.
Hmm.
And we know that that turned out really well for Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we're looking at. But the difference between France and Russia is that France actually has like unions and civil society and, you know, a sort of ability to say no. So right now it's August. It's everybody's on vacation. It's the Olympics. And
I went to Lundi Matin, Lundi Matin, which is a let's say ultra left news source in France that posts really interesting stuff. And there wasn't a ton about what's going on now because they were like, we're in the summer rhythm. We're not publishing as much.
Yeah, we're not working on it right now. Yeah,
everyone's up in Tarnac feeding the goats.
Everybody's feeding the goats. And I mean, the France Unbowed is, you know, all the political parties are preparing their like university or their summer school, like their summer conferences and stuff. So I think everything is going to be kind of on hiatus unless something happens during the Olympics. You know, nobody knows. There was a attack. There've been various attacks on like the internet and train system. And,
right.
Yeah. But just until now,
I want to get into that a little bit later. So after the Olympics, I assume there's going to be some sort of resolution to the election to some extent. And the Popular Front is preparing to put forward a candidate for prime minister that Macron could theoretically choose.
We already have a candidate. Her name is Lucy Castet, and she's or Castets, I guess we'd say in English, and she is a civil servant. She's somebody from civil society. She's to put it in old-timey English terms, we could say she's a goo-goo.
Goo-goo.
Sean, that might remind you of something.
What's a what kind of granui is a goo goo?
I only know about the goo goo dolls.
The goo goo, the good sort of good government activist, is somebody who is
sewer socialism,
for example. Yeah, so somebody who basically she has connections with the Socialist Party, but she's not a politician within, you know, she's not somebody that would have normally been picked. And she has a strong stance opposing the raising of the retirement age. And she has vowed to implement the program of the NFP. So she was able to get everybody to come to a consensus. Because remember, the NFP is composed of multiple parties that, you know, a few months ago were all feuding. So right. It's not exactly obvious that they would all come together. But they came together. They derived a program. They divided all the different districts between them. They won the election. And they got a candidate for prime minister, and they're going through and having candidates for president of the assembly and all the different little posts and stuff. So,
and Mélenchon is too radioactive, right? To be a
I wouldn't say he's too radioactive. He's just he's not the kind of person who is going to be the consensus candidate of all the different parties.
Right.
And in fact, he doesn't need to be, because this is something that maybe folks don't understand, and I didn't really even understand it 6 months ago. But what Mélenchon has done over the last, let's say, the last 10 years, maybe even more time, is he has done a maneuver to make his political line hegemonic within the French left.
Hmm.
So he's conquered the Socialist Party from outside. So he left the Socialist Party because he was sick of the Blairist, you know, Hollandist social democracy stuff.
Hmm.
He left, built a separate parallel movement, not a party, a movement, which we can talk about later if you want. And now has united the left and grown its electoral bloc to be the largest single bloc, basically with a program of his own views moderated a little bit.
Mm.
So would you say Mélenchon's tendency is a dominant within the NFP, and at least in terms of ideology?
I mean, if you look at the program, right, the program is a program of rupture. It's a program that says, you know, for example, we're going to defy the European Union. And if you listen to the way that like the other political factors talk, like the Socialist Party, for example, the Socialist Party has moved drastically towards the France Unbowed since the period of Hollande's presidency.
Hmm.
And that's just like, you know, why else would they accept this program?
Right. And Mélenchon began as a Trotskyist, right? So his program.
Yeah, he was a Lambertist. Andy, can you remind us all about Lambertism?
Yeah, please, Andy, go into your trot spotting.
Yeah, I don't remember exact. I know the term.
Damn, but he didn't know this was going to be a pop quiz, bro.
Lambert was, you know, like Posadas, kind of an unorthodox figure who kind of went his own way in the 60s, 50s or 60s. So it's
basically Mélenchon grew up as a, you know, a pretty left-wing guy, a good commie, who did not, you know, growing up as sort of that generation, the 68 generation, is not a big fan of the Prague Spring in terms of tanks rolling in and, you know, subjugating people. So he could not join the PCF, the French Communist Party, because he's not a tanky, and he was not a tanky as a kid. And so, you know, I think he was like president of the high school union. So, you know, he went from school age all the way up. And during the time of Mitterrand, of like the post-68 moment, he joined the Socialist Party, like many people did. Because if you remember, at the Congress of Epinay, I know, Andy, you're an expert in the Congress of Epinay, when François Mitterrand gets up on the stage and says, you know, anyone who is not willing to make a rupture with the established order cannot be a member of the Socialist Party.
Right? He said this as president, or he said this before?
Before, when he was like, basically, he did a sort of maneuver similar to Jean Jaurès, another historic French left figures of, you know, the French left has a tendency, as many lefts do, to sort of split into lots of different camps. And then there are moments of bring it together. So Jean Jaurès, and the, you know, at the end of the long 19th century, brings the French left together. And then it breaks apart at the Congress of Tours between the sort of Bolshevik and non-Bolshevik camps. And that leads to the Communist Party and the Socialist Party. And then François Mitterrand in the post-war, you know, post-1968 period, brings it back together with what was called the Common Program. And the Common Program was largely, you know, promoted by the Communist Party and the Socialist Party. And it included things like nationalizing banks, nationalizing all kinds of industries, retirement at 60, blah, 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 right? And so they had this Congress at Epinay where François Mitterrand basically rebaptizes the Socialist Party as a more radical party than it had previously been. And he wins an election, 1981, starts implementing the program, and then hits what a lot of people call the money wall. Do you know about the money wall, Sean?
I'm assuming that's when capital starts running away.
Do you know about the European money snake?
European money snake. I don't know.
You sound like game shows.
I'm not up on my fauna across the.
Welcome to Money Wall, featuring the European money snake. So basically, pre like Maastricht and pre all of the common currency, all the different EU like the franc and the Deutschmark and everything were all interconnected in what was called like the money snake. Right. So they all had a kind of interdependence. And you also have to remember that in this time, Europe was a lot smaller. Like the eastern border of France was with Germany. And then after Germany, it was the Warsaw Pact.
Right.
So like in terms of NATO, EU, it was a smaller world. It was a more compact world. It was a more stressful world. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to people like Mélenchon that lived through that time, and that was a militant in that time, I mean, going around with the common program, telling people we're going to make a socialist revolution and we're going to make France a socialist country. Through the ballot box. That was basically the idea. What happened was they started implementing the program, and then there was a monetary crisis and a budgetary crisis where Mitterrand and his forces, I guess you could say that they didn't pay enough attention beforehand. I mean, there's a lot of debate about this, but to kind of save time, what occurred was they could not continue their program. They ran aground, and not just because of capital flight, but like people was what we called a forced loan. So like everybody's accounts were just like debited by the government.
Oh,
they got
yeah.
paid back. But you know yeah. what I mean? Like there was all kinds of devaluation of currency, blah, 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 blah. And basically Mitterrand was afraid to repeat the Allende sequence and was afraid to repeat like hyperinflation and all the monetary problems of the 20th century.
Similar to how Syriza blinked, right?
I think it's similar to what happened in Italy as well. Even Tony Benn maybe went through a similar process.
There's a moment where the responsibility of like responsibility to revolution versus the responsibility of administering society,
right,
even a capitalist society, starts to conflict.
Good government. And you're optimistic that the program is prepared for this, but before we can get there, how is it? What kind of pressure is the NPF going to put on Macron to have their candidate selected for prime minister?
Well, let me reverse the questions just so it's a little bit clear. So people like Mélenchon that lived through that whole period of Mitterrand, right, also lived through the 1990s and the collapse of the wall and all this other stuff, right? And so they've thought about it for a long time. And basically the difference between then and now is the current program is less ambitious, so we're not proposing to nationalize all the banks. And it explicitly includes two elements which were not in the common program of Mitterrand. The first element is willingness to break the EU. Willingness to say, we're just going to refuse to play ball with the EU.
I admire that.
And basically to dare them to, you know, find out, because France is not like Greece. It's a much more important economy in Europe.
That's for sure.
It's also much more important to NATO and all these other things, right? So basically, France coming to EU and saying no is very different than Greece coming to EU and saying no.
They have the leverage.
They have more leverage. The second piece is that Mitterrand did not mobilize the people. Mitterrand didn't have people like in the streets, you know, pushing back against the monetary wall.
So you mentioned in
the NFP is prepared to do that.
So there'll be. When Macron's making this decision, there'll be mass protests in favor of the NFP?
Well, there's a term we use a lot in French that I'm still struggling to how to translate in English called a rapport de force. And a rapport de force could be like a power balance or a power struggle, depending on how you want to look at it, right? Mm. But basically, there was a failure in the Mitterrand era of a rapport de force where they were going with this huge program, but at the end of the day, they didn't actually have the punch to back it up.
I was interested in something that you said, which was that Mélenchon or the NPF adopted the website or the online interface of the Bernie Sanders campaign in terms of mobilizing people. Obviously, Sanders, you know, his ambition of creating major change in the United States was going to require something like this. And I think he was cognizant of that, of what he called our revolution. And we never got to that stage. But now do you think that that sort of interface, that sort of like, I don't know, social networking for the left can bring out the necessary rapport de force for the NPF to come into power?
Well, it's a question that we'll have to see, because it's not just a matter of, you know, the taking of the Bernie technology was for the France Unbowed in particular. And that was done basically in 2016.
Okay.
So since, if you think about like the whole Chapo, Jacobin, whatever Antifada. Era. right. If you think about that whole era, that whole time, Mélenchon and the France Unbowed had been building. Right. So that whole time over here, there's been a whole a different parallel thing going on. And I would say the difference is, let me ask you this, Sean and Andy, you tell me. What is Bernie Sanders' theory?
His theory of power?
Does he have a theory of revolution?
He's got like a weird topsy-turvy, like upside-down sort of theory that the presidency can be won as a bully pulpit and that the Democratic Party could be turned into something that it's not through the mobilization of people who don't vote, by revitalized labor movements. But that by and large, like you could have a top-down, bottom-up revolution that would like bring a new deal, a Green New Deal, if you will. That's what I understand.
So Mélenchon, whether or not we like it, Mélenchon has a historical materialist theory that he's promoted through several successive books and refined over the years.
Bernie Sanders doesn't have that.
He does not have this.
No.
Right. So Mélenchon and the France Unbowed has a particular theory. They test different theories or theses. They do hypotheses of like how to do marketing, how to do positioning. And then they change tack based on that, right? And so the thing with the social network is like, if you want to join the France Unbowed, you don't have to sign up for anything in terms of like being a member of a political party. You don't have to pay anything. You don't have any obligations. It's literally just a website. You can go on it. You can find events. You can find local groups. You can get added to Telegram groups or whatever. You can go to like a beach party or a bar or whatever and meet folks. And you can show up to like pro-Palestine stuff, electoral stuff, whatever the local groups are, you know, organizing. But just by making that all public and easily available, it's extremely easy to find people and organize people. I was at a beach party the other day with, I want to say like 80 people. And I'm not in like a left-wing area.
And it was organized through this website.
Yeah, through the France Unbowed. And then all the other parties have their own, you know, Robert's Rule of Order type internal organization. The unions have their organization, and all of these things are converging in the NFP. So if, for example, the CGT says we're going to go on strike during the Olympics, we're going to go on strike during the Olympics.
Is that happening?
Well, this was asked directly to the secretary, Sophie Binet, who said, you know, if I had a button on my desk called General Strike that I could just push, I would love that, you know, but she doesn't have that.
But there are.
It's a question of a rapport de force. It's a question of, you know, if Macron just straight up nominates a right wing dude to be the prime minister, okay, just hypothetically, like one of the Republican ex post Gaullist people, and then just tries to shut the NFP out of power, I think there is a serious risk of social contestation because it would basically be a stolen election.
So it would be, you would see political strikes, you're saying? You would see mass mobilizations potentially?
I mean, it's on the table that people could show up. Like, why would we go out? Think about this. Like, think about the Venezuela situation, right? Everybody's like, what's the results of the election? Is Maduro legitimate or not, right? What's the risk of that? If the election breaks down, if people don't have confidence in the result of the election, what's the alternative? People go into the street.
Here's a question for you. Given the results of this election, which seems to be like 33% New Popular Front, 33% Fash or post-Fash, and then 33% sort of like vague centrist types or whatever. Like, if there was a mass mobilization, if there was something like an insurrection combined with a general strike, do you think it's possible for a sizable element of the other 66% of people who didn't vote for the New Popular Front to be brought on board with this? Or are we looking at something approaching a civil war with like a third of society and a third of society and a third of society, a complete
deadlock?
I don't
know if there's going to be a civil war. It's possible that. So we have to take a step back really quick.
Sure.
The next round of like big elections is in 2027 for the next presidential, right? Macron can't call another legislative election for a year. Mm. So we have at least a year of this situation. So in that year, the question is how conflictual it will be and how politicizing is it? And I think we'll have, information about that at back to school time. So like in September, we'll see what happens. Mm. It's possible that people will say, I don't care about parliamentary chicanery, whatever. I voted for the New Popular Front. Nothing changed. I'm demobilized and we have a far right government and this is all for nothing. It's also possible that we have a mass uprising of people out in the streets demanding Macron resign. He resigned and we have a totally new government and blah, blah, blah. And something in between is possible, right? And I can't look beyond this sort of barrier of the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know that people are organizing and people are preparing and we're having meetings all the time. And, I'm talking to people and it's a moment of politicization, even though it's the summer vacation.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame this conjuncture. And it gets to my question about the connection with the U.S. context, because over the last, since we've recorded, there was this, I don't know if you could call it really a political struggle, but a political moment where it was clear Biden was going to lose the election. And there was this immense pressure both within the Democratic Party and from their donors, but also just from the Democratic base to replace him. Within that, these different coalitions of, like donors, Democratic apparatchiks, and then kind of progressives and leftists online who were all coconut-pilled, right? And like the demand of this movement or moment was bring in Kamala essentially for anti-fascist reasons because Biden was going to lose. And so that worked. Kamala's now the nominee. Now we're in this moment that's kind of absurd to me where these coconut pill people are like, well, now we need Kamala to select a progressive VP.
Right.
Jacobin said Bernie is ready to go.
Yeah.
Tanned, rested, and ready.
He is a white man.
He's ready, folks.
He might be
He's
too
80
old.
Years old.
He might be too old, yeah. A white man. But I think that's particularly absurd to me because it's like you were pushing for Kamala not for political reasons, but for electoral reasons because you think she can beat Trump. And sure, there's these arguments that Bashir or Waltz or Bernie might be more electable or like a good electable choice as a VP. But in reality, the electability is not, it's not a political issue of the first order. Whatever Shapiro's politics are, he seals up Pennsylvania. Harris needs Pennsylvania to win. And so in my mind, you can't really put politics back into that situation because you've already sort of depoliticized the whole question with electability.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
There's no program there. Like, what is the positive case for Harris, right? With the NFP, we have a program.
Yeah, that's the big difference, right?
This is the thing I wish, like, people in the DSA that are listening to this or folks that read Jacobin or whatever would listen to this and think about this. How did we get to this position where the French left is talking about rupture and, a break with productivism, ecocide, and has, like, a pretty radical program relative to other Western countries? How is that the case? It's the case that instead of debating about theory and trying to come up with a theoretical basis that we all agree on, instead of sort of submissively bootlicking, and I'm sorry if I'm using terms that are offensive to folks, but the way that people on the American left have been kissing up to Biden, I think is shameful. Mm-hmm. The French left said, like the Mélenchon camp, for example, said, no, we're going to prove our own theories apart from you, and then you're going to come. And you're going to try to be like us because we're going to succeed. And they succeeded and they proved their thesis on the basis of a concrete program. So at the end of the day, maybe you're a Maoist, Sean. Maybe Andy is a Trotskyist. Maybe I'm a liberal. But we all decide that the program is the good program. And we get behind the program and we're going to implement the program as best we can. And if we can't, like let's say Macron prevents us or something happens that prevents us, we can at least go to the voters and say, you voted for us for the program. We pushed the program. We held the line. If you continue to support us, we'll continue to push the program.
Yeah.
And I think that's easy to understand and clear. And what's really unclear to me is the American quote unquote socialist politicians and what is their situation like.
Well, they don't have their own party. I mean, there's substantial differences between the Fifth Republic and the ancient and decrepit first past the post American democratic system, quote unquote, or democratic Republican system. A lot of these debates just become moot when our Popular Front is simply, as Andy, I think, brilliantly put forth, trying to be a pressure group within one of the two capitalist parties that turns out doesn't have a lot of leverage whatsoever. And so falls into line constantly with like the left wing of like what some people would say is the lesser of two evils. But I think actually these days might be just as evil, if not more. So there's
I was invited the other day to dinner with a bunch of 68ers. And we all watched the Olympics.
Soisson Huitards.
Soisson Huitards en complet, you know. they were doing pretty well. They have a nice garden. They have some tortoises in the garden. Oh, yeah. My kid liked to give salad to the tortoises or whatever.
As you
and
should.
We were watching the Olympic opening ceremony and, you know, clapping for all the wokeism and enjoying. We really enjoyed the whole Marie Antoinette fire medal sequence.
Oh, they must have loved that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We love that over here.
The guys at my work think that's all Satanism. I had to.
Oh, well, it is. Yeah. I mean, it is. Obviously, we all denounced that on the Antifada program.
Was that at the Hotel de Ville where the metal band played with Marie Antoinette?
That's the Conciergerie. Oh, okay. So the Hotel de Ville is on the other side of the Seine, and then you have the Louvre, and then you go to the left bank, and that's where the Ile de la Cité, the sort of historic, ancient, where like Notre Dame is and a bunch of stuff. And the Conciergerie was, in fact, an ancient palace.
Okay.
And it was where Marie Antoinette was held prisoner awaiting execution.
I thought it was like the Hotel de Ville, which is the base of the Paris Commune, and...
If I'm not mistaken, the Communards burned down both the Hotel de Ville and the Medici Palace that was formerly in the front of the Louvre. So if you go to the Louvre, it's kind of like a U shape and then facing this big garden, right? The Garden of Tuileries. There used to be a palace that closed off that U to be a courtyard, and that was destroyed fully in the Communist, my understanding.
21st century French postmodern popular culture, Olympics culture, is able to somehow synthesize 1789 pretty all right, but they draw the line at 1871, bro. You can't bring that back into the sport.
At the next Olympics, they're going to have the Winter Olympics with like a little Blanqui going out in prison. Exactly. You know,
skiing down the slopes.
Skiing down the slopes in a little prison. No, but I was going to say, at this dinner with the 68ers, you know, folks are always asking me about America. And a bunch of them, and a lot of these people, you know, some of them were even like socialist mayors of little towns or villages in the Mitterrand era who are now in the France Unbowed. And they were just telling me, like, we believe that what we're doing to succeed, we need an international movement. And we believe that the United States needs to make a revolution. And we believe that the world revolution will begin in America. And I'm just like,
whoa, sure. It sounded like Chris Coutrone and Spencer.
I was just like, all right.
Sounds like C.L.R. James. Engels said something pretty similar at one point as well. So
I think we all kind of have that sense, right? Like the center of the empire, the core is where it has to happen. I think we got to keep fighting here, come up with some new good ideas. Do you have any buyer's remorse about, because I didn't realize this when you first came on, and I understand the tactical reasons why you did it, but strategically, popular front candidates dropping out and endorsing Macronist candidates?
That's normal. That's normal. In fact, I'll give you an example of this.
Yeah.
This also proves our bona fides, because there's a sort of discourse about the Republican arc, right? And the whole like cordon sanitaire is about the far right not being a normal group, right? And in the last like 5 years, the center and the center right have been trying to say like, actually, the France Unbowed is not normal. And also, the Greens are not normal. And like, you know where this stream of denunciations is going to end up.
Socialists
aren't normal.
Just like the Democrats.
Right? Yeah, you're weird, right?
Yeah.
But by consistently, by the New Popular Front being like disciplined and rigorous and consistent and saying, we will every time we will desist where it's strategically necessary, I think that shows that we're like ethically and politically serious and disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And whereas like the Macronists, remember I told you about COT?
Society.
Again? You remember I told you about COT, the right-wing guy that joined with the far right?
Yeah.
Oh,
who, like,
yeah.
Locked himself in the office?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you look at the election results of his district, which is the center of Nice, like the old town center of Nice, in the first round, he failed to get an absolute majority. So it was like him and then the New Popular Front and then the Macron candidate. In between the two rounds, the Macron candidate refused to drop out, which happened a lot because they're not disciplined and they're not ethically serious, right?
Mm-hmm.
even
they're
though
not that opposed not, to Le Penism, right?
Yeah, they're not that opposed to Le Penism, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
But if you look at, we only had like a very short time during the campaign, if you remember, like literally a matter of weeks during the campaign. The NFP jumped like 7 or 8 points in between the first and second round without a desistance. Okay. We were in a realistic ability to surpass him in the election results.
You put Ciotti in a bullseye.
No, did not do that. That Biden not, says. I have no ill will towards Eric Ciotti. I wish him many years. You know, I just don't want him to be in power. So I think that shows something. Like even in a far right district, oh, you know, Nice is like, oh, far right, oh, blah blah blah. Like he only won by what, like 10 percentage points? It wasn't like a huge victory. It could have been overcome if the Macron guy had quit.
I admire the seriousness and the discipline that you're talking about. I really true do admire that. I can't imagine what a serious and disciplined left would look like in the United States, because there hasn't been one probably since the Socialist Party of 115 years ago or so. But it really is fascinating to take a look across the pond and see ways in which things might be different. Now, you can't import like the New Popular Front model, of course, directly into America. But I think it, like, as much as Mélenchon, it was working on experimenting and there's different theses and you test them, I think it's a very powerful moment for us to look over there and see the things that are working.
Well, think about the ILC, Sean, right?
I think about it every day.
But think about the last episode released about the ILC and this loss of the left, right?
Yeah.
What do you do given that, right? Mélenchon faced similar things and he went and he had a hard think. And he realized that there's a sort of level of historical materialist analysis that was unexplored, a sort of anthropological level regarding population growth and movements of people and migration, things like this. And so if I can sort of simplify and bastardize the theory, it's that in our epoch, in the 21st century, we need a new theory of action fit for our time. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's not so radical to say. What is this theory? We're witnessing historic record levels of urbanization and population growth, such that there's never been this many people around, this educated, this interconnected, and this dependent on networks, whether it be social networks, electric grid, food networks, etc. Right. So society, contrary to this is not a program, is dividing into two molar heaps, those who are dependent on local networks and those who are not dependent on such networks. Those who are dependent, the multitude who live in cities who are rapidly urbanizing, that are younger and better, you know, educated and connected than ever before, that are migrating across the world. This is a new historical subject that, if it takes its destiny in its hands, goes from just being a sort of a crowd to being a people, to being the people, capital P, to becoming citizens in the sense that these are people engaged in their own self-determination and sovereignty. And so the revolution, or sometimes it's called the insurrection, that Mélenchon is proposing, the citizens' insurrection, the citizens' revolution, is this idea of these people constituting a new political force, a new historical subject that takes power and, like in the French case, would establish a new constitution through a new constituent assembly and thereby a new people legally. And this includes everybody that's, you know, immigrant, native born, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Now, I've condensed this radically. The left, the historic left, like the workers' movement, isn't abolished. It's a part of this. But the workers' movement is no longer the like motor of the whole thing. It's no longer the linchpin of the whole thing. Because just if you look at like the number of people in organized labor, it's an order of magnitude less than it used to be. Now, what role do they play? If you look at, you know, Mélenchon likes to cite the Tunisian example. The organized labor has the ability, because it's disciplined and organized already, to sort of teach and spread those techniques and generalize them to other people in the moment of rupture, right? But this rupture is not brought by a central party or by, you know, syndicalist federations or anything like this. It's brought by a social movement of people that has both a street element and an electoral element. Yeah. And you can have a civil society element and a union element, obviously, within it. Right. But yeah, all of these forces have to be arrayed.
And that's really interesting. And, you know, on the last episode, we were talking about the Bordiguist critique of the Popular Front. And since then, I've been on the hunt for new critiques of the New Popular Front. And what I've mostly found from Lundi Matan and from ICT, and they were all going back to the 30s. They were essentially republishing arguments from the 30s against the Popular Front, when you had communists appealing to this workers' movement that still existed to be critical of the Popular Front for various good reasons that the criticism certainly still apply today. But the criticisms are mostly saying, like, look, the Popular Front takes power. They are going to perform the functions of the state. They will suppress the working class movement, putting off fascism in the short term, or doing what fascism is meant to do, which is holding the capitalist state together. And so I agree with, I think, the sentiment that you expressed last time, that those critiques don't really help us in this context. And because we don't have that workers' movement. I mean, France certainly has more of one than the United States, but nothing compared to the 20s and 30s.
Or the 50s and 60s.
Sure. This concept of using a Popular Front to rebuild a new class movement is interesting to me.
Yeah.
And if there's good critiques out there, please put them in the show notes.
What was the critique of Ortega in On Activism? His argument is that, basically, activism makes you feel good, Sean. It strokes that dopamine, whatever liberal bullshit technological terminology we use today to talk about the psychology of our miserable lives. It, you know, strokes that itch and makes you feel like you've accomplished something, but there's no theory behind it. You're just running in the hamster wheel, basically. Right? And what I've been telling you this whole show is that there is a theory behind what we're doing. So does this critique land? I would argue it does not land. It's not activism if you actually have a theory and a group of people that have reflected and acted in accordance with that reflection.
I am never going to yuck anybody else's yum. And I think that what you guys are doing is far different, I think, than what happened in the 1930s and is, you know, what's happening now across the rest of the capitalist world. And I'm withholding judgment, except that I trust you as our Antifada France correspondent to have worked these things out and to continue to come back and give us the straight dope on this shit. I'm pretty hyped for what you guys are doing.
Can I just ask you for help, Andy?
Okay.
I am starting a new publication called The New International. It's an English language publication that's looking for editors. I'm assembling an editorial team now to try to get normal, regular reports from various places in the world, including France, so that we all actually have a place to look for critiques. So it's a partisan publication, right? It's not like anybody can come with any ideas, but it's non-sectarian. So you're allowed to disagree with me and you can say that I'm wrong, right? So we're working on this. We're hoping to launch this soon. And I will be continuing to publish updates there. If anybody is interested in helping with the project, they know where to find me.
Hell yeah.
So what were you going to say, Andy? I cut you off accidentally.
Okay. So yeah, one critique from, you know, these 30s critiques that I do think might hold the test of time. When we submit the workers' movement to an electoral bloc, we see a little bit about what I was talking about in like the Veep stakes in the United States right now, is you get a lot of people focus very heavily on this maneuvering between different representatives. Or
it's the opposite situation. The electeds here are not dominating anything. The electeds are like downstream of the power, right? So the electeds are under pressure from the union, from civil society, from the social movements to get their shit together.
Right, but you also...
That's why the New Popular Front exists.
You also expressed concern a moment ago that perhaps when everyone comes back from vacation and it's time to apply that pressure in the streets or otherwise, they might say, well, I already voted for the NPF.
Yeah, you know, people might be tired.
The people in power can take it from here, which is, a big impulse behind people supporting Kamala as well. Is like, I just want to go back to brunch. And I think that could win her the election. And, you know, part of the reason I want Kamala to win, for example, is I don't want to do the resistance again. Not that the resistance was so bad, but it was just exhausting and depressing and stupid for most of it. And I don't know that it'll be any better this time. It'll probably be different. But so even me, I've got that, like, can't we just go back to brunch thing and not have to worry about the Trump bullshit? And I think that's a pretty natural inclination that results from this depolitization, demobilization that comes with the electoral spectacle.
How do I respond to this? Basically, the theory has been proven that the common program of the New Popular Front can actually win electorally. The question is, does the electoral bloc hold together? Just until now, it has held together. with all the different, you know, pressure of the media, et cetera, the chicanery to try to break it, which Macron has been trying to break it hard and he's not been able to crack it yet. That's the first thing. The second thing is a question like you're saying, I cannot predict what people are going to do when they come home from vacation. I don't know. If I can evoke Blanqui, that nobody knows, mm-hmm. right? There's a kind of barrier beyond which nobody can see, right? So I don't know.
But I think
the third thing is if they do or not. Like, let's say they don't. Let's say people say, fuck it, I'm not going to come back and fight. Okay, well, what have we learned? Well, we've learned that the populist right can be defeated, that there is an alternative to Bernieism and Corbynism and this kind of like left populist with no theory movements, and that the center is vulnerable. So we've learned at least some things, you know?
Sure. And yeah, the future is unwritten. But I think the fact that people, you know, do go on vacation, for instance, is indicative that we're not in this pre-revolutionary moment. And it's not like anyone could have done something differently to change that. Just the last thing I want to talk about or ask about is about the sabotage leading up to the Olympics. Does that represent a different non-electoral poll in France that we haven't discussed yet? I mean, we don't know who did it.
This is funny.
But like, what would be your guess?
The media ran with the idea that it was an ultra-left, extreme-left sabotage or whatever. And it turned out the police had just arrested somebody for spray painting graffiti. Around the same time that this sabotage occurred, the police also arrested somebody.
Oh, and they put it on, they pinned it on like a graffiti writer. Okay.
They didn't even pin it on it. It was just, it so happened that the sabotage occurred, right, at like 8 a.m. At 10 a.m., or I don't know the exact time, so whatever, like a few hours later, the police arrest a guy who has keys to like a train closet, and he has, you know, some books about the ZAD at Notre Dame de Londres and like eco stuff, and he was tagging, right? Wow. And so then the France's top cop goes on the morning shows and they're like, and we do have at least one individual associated with the ultra left who has been arrested. And then all the media ran with that.
Right.
And then a few days later, it turns out that it was like a kid who wanted to spray paint some stuff.
But regardless if it's the ultra left or not, but my question is, do you think that that action indicates that there is
No, I think
more...
it's a state actor.
Okay.
Yeah.
You think it's a false flag?
Like What brought down the fiber optic network? Why were like people not able to work the other day? It could be internal sabotage. I don't know. It could be. I would assume it's a state actor.
Qui bono? I mean, who's got it against the Olympics?
Like Russia is pretty pissed because they're excluded from the Olympics.
Fair enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it is good to give Macron a black eye. And a lot of people hate Macron. So.
I would assume if somebody did it as sabotage, they would have like claimed it and made a big to do about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, we're in a wait and see stage, as I think internationally we are. I mean, I'm waiting to see right now if like World War III is going to kick off later tonight.
Oh boy, yeah, in the Middle East.
Why do you think World War III is going to kick off?
The assassinations, I'm assuming, right, Andy?
Yeah, I think maybe some missiles are headed to Tel Aviv right now.
Are they?
I'm not positive. There's some talk about
that.
Do
you doubt the collective leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Andy, to act in a rational and coherent way?
Oh, well,
I'm hoping they do.
At what
are you doubting the anti-imperialist camp, Andy?
I'm definitely doubting the anti-imperialist.
He does that every day. Every day he's.
Did you all figure out who is the president of Venezuela?
Maduro.
Maduro, as I understand it.
I think it would be false to say that he won, or we don't know if he won. He says he's going to release the evidence that he won, but we don't have that yet. So.
You rolling with AMLO? You're going to wait for AMLO to make a statement?
Well, AMLO already said, you know, give us the information we need to verify the election. Or not AMLO,
but receipts.
Maduro's allies in Brazil and Mexico have also doubted the election.
Well, let me turn the tables on you before we close the program. What do we need to do on our side to prove the theory? Because I think, Andy, you were pretty clear that nobody's offered a really serious critique of the NFP just until now.
I'm sure people have. I haven't found it. Yeah.
I haven't found it either. So what would we need to do to prove the theory in your eyes?
I think you would have to, you know, you talked about this network, the ability to mobilize a network around a platform. If that's able to get some NFP wins, if we can have a NFP wins Twitter account, and you know, like the next time,
how many wins do they have to rack up?
The next time it comes time to fight Macron on whatever labor reform he wants to do. I think he does have some more economic and labor reforms coming down the pipe. If they can defeat that, parliamentary wise and in the streets, I think that would be indication of a broader political power than simply a new social democratic party.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time as well.
Every time you come on, I learn something new, and I think the listeners do too. And I think that having you on at least every few months, or when you know politics things pop off in France, is a great idea. So thanks for all your contributions, man.
Yeah, and I look forward to the upcoming History as a Weapon about when Garibaldi supported Blanqui's electoral campaign.
All right. Well, Matt's going to keep healing up, and we'll work on that.
Well, Garibaldi was supposed to come to the U.S. and lead the Union Army, right?
Something like
the
that.
The hero of the two worlds.
Our new Lafayette. Well, maybe we'll need Mélenchon to come and lead lead the American
Mélenchon's
going to
come over here and just spittle.
We'll take
He's getting old, man.
All right, guys. Yo, get some sleep, man.
All right, thanks, Henry.
Take care. Ciao, ciao.
Later, brother.